This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Mariah Mitchell, the first professional female astronomer and a Nantucket native, once said, We especially need imagination in science. It's not all mathematics nor all logic, but it is somewhat beauty and poetry. There's certainly no shortage of beauty and mystery when we look at the night sky. For centuries, astronomers have been watching the stars and trying to figure out how the universe works and how we fit into the picture. Most of us have at some point looked up and wondered some of those same things. Indeed, modern astronomy is built on the backs of an army of amateur observers. So today, with National Astronomy Day, the second National Astronomy Day this year, coming up this Saturday on the 12th, we are turning to some local astronomers for later this hour, a tour of the night sky. We'll talk about what drives these astronomers and what is going on at local observatories. Here in the studio with me is Ed Swiniarski. He's a retired astronomer and meteorologist, currently secretary of the Cape Cod Astronomical Foundation, which is the governing body for the Cape Cod Astronomical Society and the Werner Schmidt Observatory at the Dennis Yarmouth High School. And on the line from Nantucket, we have Dr. Michael West, Director of Astronomy at Nantucket's Mariah Mitchell Association, a post he assumed just this past spring. Before that, he spent 6 years as head of science for the European Southern Observatory in Chile, where the world's largest telescope is under construction. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Heather.
Thank you.
And we welcome your questions and comments as well. You can reach us toll-free at 866-999-4626 or email us at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Now, let's start. Both of you have these observatories that, at least to me, I've been on the Cape for over 15 years, and they seem like they're kind of hidden away. So let's first just give folks a view of what is going on at your observatories. And Michael, let's start with you. The Mariah Mitchell Association has, I take it, two telescopes at your observatory.
That's right, Heather. We actually have three telescopes, but we have two that are open for the public. It's our Loynes Observatory, it's called. And we actually have 1,000 visitors, more than 1,000 visitors this past summer. We get a lot of people coming out. As you know, Nantucket gets many visitors every summer. And also local residents are, of course, well aware of our observatory. So we have, in the summertime, quite a busy schedule. Even now in the fall, we're still open once a week. And we get quite significant crowds when the weather is good. So we've got two telescopes out there. We've got a beautiful antique telescope built in 1908. That's been restored, and it works really nice, and it's really nice for looking at the moon and the planets in particular. And then we've got a large 24-inch telescope that we use for research, but this past summer we also put an eyepiece on it so that the public can actually look through it. And so that's been a really nice opportunity for people to look at distant galaxies, distant stars. We look at exploding stars. We look at planets. We look at all of those things. And then the beauty of Nantucket is the skies are really dark out here, of course, because we're 30 miles out to sea. There's not a lot of light pollution. So on a good night, the Milky Way is just spectacular going overhead, for example.
I take it, though, that being out to sea can also have some drawbacks, that the stars look a little bit different when you're that close to the ocean.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're often looking through moist air. I mean, I've been out at the observatory many nights when it's really clear to start, and all of a sudden this wall of fog comes in out of nowhere. But that's, it's life in a maritime climate. And also, because we're at sea level, the air is a little bit more turbulent. And so what happens is the stars are a little bit puffier than you would see if you were, say, up at the top of a mountain. And that's why we build, the world's biggest telescopes on tops of mountains generally. But that aside, I mean, the beauty out here is that we do have very dark skies. And also with our telescopes, we have access to them 365 days a year in principle, whereas, trying to get time on other telescopes around the world, it's highly competitive and you're sort of lucky to get a few nights. So you have both the advantages and the disadvantages, of course.
Now, Ed, the Werner Schmidt Observatory that the Cape Cod Astronomical Society runs, it's on the grounds of the Dennis Yarmouth High School.
That's correct.
And you've got a few telescopes there, a couple of the 8-inch telescopes and then also a 16-inch telescope.
We have two fairly large telescopes. One is the 16-inch, is the principal telescope we use. And we also have an 18-inch reflecting telescope, which is a beautiful instrument, and it is portable. It's actually movable so that we can have one inside the observatory dome itself and the other we can roll outside. And both of those are computer controlled, and they are very beautiful telescopes for the public and for the students.
So let's dig into the technology here for a second. First of all, when we say inches, for a telescope, is that literally just the diameter of the lens?
It is the diameter of the lens or mirror, depending upon what type of telescope it is. And why that's an issue is a telescope is essentially a gigantic light bucket. So the larger your in diameter your lens or mirror is, the more light you can collect, which gives you brighter images, but also you can see further into the universe.
So when we're talking, Michael West, about a 24-inch telescope, how far away can you see with something like that?
Well, it depends on how bright the objects are you're looking at, of course, but certainly we can see galaxies. We can even see some quasars that are, you know, millions, billions of light years away. So part of the challenge, too, is when you look with just your eye through an eyepiece, you know, our eyes aren't the most sensitive light detectors, in a sense. Like Ed made the analogy of a light bucket. And so it doesn't make a lot of sense for trying to do research to build as big a telescope as you can than to put our little tiny pupil at the end of it, because our eyes just aren't that sensitive. But with a camera that we attach to the telescope, for example, we can leave the shutter open all night and record, you know, the buildup of light from very, very distant, very faint objects that could be millions, even billions of light years away.
Now, I think when we talk about modern astronomy, we're often talking about space-based telescopes like the Hubble or some of these very large telescopes and the radio arrays where you've got, you know, a huge number of radio telescopes essentially all working together. What is it that small observatories like these here on the Cape and Islands can actually contribute to what we're discovering about the universe now in modern astronomy?
Well, one of the things that's the Werner Schmidt Observatory functions as two things. It's both a club telescope, if you will, a membership, and also a research telescope. Believe it or not, even though these aren't monster telescopes, there are many things that smaller telescopes, smaller observatories, and amateurs like we are as officially can do. And the big astronomers with the big telescopes in the Hubble, you know, they don't have time for a lot of small things. And very often the national and international organizations will contact us and say, we'd like you to look at something for us, maybe an asteroid eclipsing a star, variable stars, measuring things. These are still important things that many people can do with small telescopes, and we use that is our teaching aid.
So it's not necessarily that you guys are just out there observing what you're interested in, and when you see something interesting, you report that to a scientist. You guys are actually essentially taking assignments from professional scientists.
Yes, we are.
Mm-hmm. Now, you guys were actually involved in verifying the exoplanet that was recently discovered, correct?
We did. We weren't sure we were going to be able to do that, and that was given us as a challenge, and we worked at it, and as Mike said, by taking a lot of observations and pictures and what have you, we were able to actually verify the data that there was an exoplanet that we didn't think our small telescopes could do it, but we did.
So what did you actually see? What did that look like to verify it?
It's more numbers and statistics, because you don't actually see the little planet. What you detect is the motion of the star that it's around as it wobbles around, thanks to the motion of the planet going around the star. The star actually wobbles a little bit in its position.
So you're actually able to measure just that very small change.
Yes.
Now, and you guys are also, I take it, involved in monitoring near-Earth asteroids, which of course have gotten a lot of press recently since we actually had an asteroid that hit in Russia.
In Russia. Yeah, we... One of our members is very, very keen on timing asteroid occultations, where an asteroid goes in front of a star and blocks out the light of the star for a while. It makes a difference in the orbit. And many of these asteroids, the orbits are not all that well known. They're predicted, and they're predicted very well, but astronomers want to know more accurately these numbers. And that's something we can do, and we do on a regular basis.
So when you take on these assignments from professional astronomers, you have your data, whether it's about the exoplanet or about these near-Earth asteroids. What happens once you have those observations? You turn that back over to the professionals, and do you guys get credit in the publication process? Or?
I'm not sure how much credit we get, but we do. It goes back to the organization that sends us the original order. It could be the American Astrophysical Association, Harvard, Smithsonian, the American Association of Variable Stars Observers. All these are kind of organizations that funnel information.
Now, Michael West, you just came to Nantucket this past spring after a whole career at some of the largest telescopes in the world. How is what you're doing now in terms of research? How much research are you doing, and how is it different from what you were doing, say, in Chile or Hawaii or Nova Scotia before?
Oh, that's a good question. I think, you know, the sky is so huge and there's so many objects we still don't know about. There's never enough telescopes to cover everything. And so different telescopes of different sizes all make their contribution. And so, you know, in 2 weeks, I'm going to Hawaii to use the Keck telescope, which is the world's biggest one. And you can only do certain projects with the world's biggest telescope. But there are other telescopes like the ones here, the ones on the Cape, that certainly play a very valuable role in trying to do research. So, for example, this summer, every summer here at the Murray Mitchell Observatory, we have 6 university students come out, and they spend the summer doing research projects with us. They learn to use the telescope, which is great hands-on experience. And this summer, they were looking for what we call cannibal galaxies. These are galaxies that are slowly eating other galaxies. Our Milky Way, for example, is a cannibal. It's actually eating 2 or 3 other galaxies at the moment. And so our students use this telescope to do some original research, trying to look for other examples of this sort of galaxy cannibalism that's going on around us. And, you know, you can't get weeks of time to do this at any of the large telescopes out there. So there's definitely a niche for the smaller telescopes. They can contribute in many ways, as you were just talking about, whether it's, you know, looking for near-Earth asteroids or even looking at galaxies and things like that. There's just so many objects out there. You know, astronomers need all the help we can get, basically, with as many telescopes as we can get.
Well, you know, there's a long history of amateurs being involved in astronomy, and I guess part of it is this just the sheer scope of what we're trying to study when we're looking at the entire universe. But I wonder if also part of it is the fact that a lot of astronomy is observational. It's not necessarily going out and designing an experiment. It's pretty much looking at what's out there, measuring it. Does that make it more accessible to amateur scientists?
I think so, yes. I mean, I think, you know, as you say, there's a long history. I mean, one of the most famous astronomers in history, William Herschel, the guy that discovered the planet Uranus and did a lot of important work, he was an amateur astronomer initially. In fact, he supported himself as a musician. And so there's a long history of amateurs contributing to astronomy. And I think part of the appeal is astronomy is such a visual science, right? I mean, you look at those beautiful images from Hubble Space Telescope or other telescopes, and it's just breathtaking. And the fact that, an amateur astronomer, even somebody with little astronomy background in some cases, can still participate in these citizen science projects is a wonderful opportunity. And I think the thing that really drives people to that is the feeling that they really are making a genuine contribution to the advancement of science. And astronomy, I think, is just so visually appealing to people. I think that, and sort of mind-bending, too, some of the concepts. I think that's really what appeals to people.
Yeah, well, I mean, in recent years, we've even heard, you know, teenagers making major discoveries that getting to go and present at conferences, that this really is a science that everybody can participate in. And you know, also everybody, you know, has at some point looked up and been in awe of the sky, as you said, inspiring to everybody.
Absolutely. I cannot, I'm getting to the point where names get out of my head, but 3 or 4 years ago, there was a young student, a female student at one of the local schools who actually had an asteroid. She was able to discover an asteroid and had it named after her. Well, she got to choose the name. I don't remember what she chose the name was, but she got to choose the name of an asteroid.
That's pretty cool. Hmm. I mean, it's also pretty amazing to think that, I mean, I know the universe is enormous, but I still find it amazing that there are sciences, and this happens, we occasionally, you know, do still discover new species and get to name a new species, but that there are stars and planets and asteroids up there still just to be discovered and named that we didn't even know existed.
The universe
before.
Is a wonderful place.
And I can't believe that someone ever actually had to support themselves as a musician in order to support their astronomy habit. I think that's a little bit the, you know, we're used to hearing about the starving artists, and instead somehow it must be pretty bad when you have to support yourself as a musician to actually do your science as a hobby.
He loved music too.
All right, in case you're just joining us, my guests this hour are retired astronomer and meteorologist Ed Twiniarski and Dr. Michael West, Director of Astronomy for Nantucket Mariah Mitchell Association. We invite you to join our conversation as well. If you have questions or comments, you can give us a call toll-free at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can email us at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Now, before the break, we were starting to talk a little bit about how many people do get involved in astronomy and why it is so inspiring to people. So I wanted to ask you both if you would tell us a little bit about how you first got interested and involved in astronomy. So Ed Swiniarski, why don't you tell us, what was it that inspired you to become an astronomer?
The planet Saturn.
The rings.
I think Mike said it earlier that, you know, looking through a telescope and seeing things astronomy is very visual. And when I was a young kid, my father, I must have been 13, my father bought me a little telescope. And the first thing I looked for was the planets, Jupiter and Saturn. I looked at Saturn and what a gorgeous sight it was with the rings, look like a great pearl. To this day, every time we show at the observatory, when somebody looks at Saturn, they go, "Wow, it's just a beautiful thing to see." And you get kind of hooked. And I got hooked that way and looked at more and more things in the sky. And science was always interesting to me all through school. So that's what really got me going. And originally I was going to be thinking about being a meteorologist full time.
So what was the connection for you between your love of astronomy and meteorology?
I don't know. Maybe it was just looking up at the sky, seeing clouds, seeing stars. I don't know what the difference was. But when I was back in my day, there was no undergraduate meteorology program in New England. You had to go to Penn State or somewhere like that. And I just wasn't going to do that. So I ended up more in the astronomy line, but then taking meteorology courses as a sidelight. But astronomy always was the issue.
And how did astronomy then become part of your career?
It happened that I went to Boston University, and what I did after college was get a job with the federal government. My specialty was calculating orbits, which I still do actually now at the observatory in Yarmouth, and the government had need for people calculating orbits of things. And that's how, that's pretty much what I did with my career in astronomy.
Now, Michael West, you've been more in the academic research side of things, but what got you started on astronomy?
I was always interested in the night sky, of course. There's just something really beautiful about a star-filled sky. But the thing that really did it for me was when I was in high school, I read a book by Carl Sagan called The Cosmic Connection. And it talked about the possibility of life in the universe. And it was by far the most interesting thing I'd ever read in my life to that point. And so it just blew me away. And I thought, well, I'll have a telescope someday. I'm going to really get into astronomy. I'll be an amateur astronomer. And then I learned that I could actually do this for a living. And I said, sign me up. So that's
a wonderful discovery.
So
I, huh?
You know, to me, this is being an astronomer is the best job on the planet. I can't believe I get a paycheck to do this. It's so much fun. That's what really hooked me. I always kind of regretted never, you know, sending a letter to Carl Sagan just to tell him how much he'd influenced my life and many other astronomers, of course. I just felt sort of awkward to write to him. And it shows the power of a book or, as I was saying, an image, right? I mean, the same thing, you know, people come out here and they look at Saturn and the two comments they always make are, wow, that is so cool. Or they say, that's fake because it looks, you know, too good through the telescope, sort of. And the other thing that never fails to really blow people away is the moon. When they look at the moon through a telescope also, I think that can be sort of transformational for people. It's just really quite a powerful moment for many people.
Now, you've said that not just doing astronomy in general, but that coming to the Mariah Mitchell Association was a dream job for you. Why is coming to Nantucket such an opportunity?
Well, for me personally, I mean, it's I wasn't looking for a job. I was living in Chile. I was working for a European organization. We're building the world's biggest telescope there. That's quite exciting. But, you know, my two passions are public outreach and education about astronomy and working with students. And so here I get to do both. It combines my two passions and a chance to try and do things creatively to say, okay, what can we do today that's going to make people more aware of astronomy or to understand where we are in the universe and those sorts of things. So it, for me, it's a perfect combination. We get great students out here every summer. We have 6 students, and we had 180 applications this year. So we get some of the best students in the country, and it's great to do research projects with them. And then I get to do public outreach and show people the wonders of the universe through the telescope. I write an astronomy column for the newspaper out here, and it's just really enjoyable.
Now, our production assistant, Alicia Lebeda, actually went to last week's meeting of the Cape Cod Astronomical Society last Thursday night and spoke with one of the new members about what it is that has inspired her now to get involved in astronomy and amateur astronomy. And she brought us this little audio postcard of her conversation.
When did you start getting into stargazing? I couldn't tell you the exact moment, but it's always been an interest. This is the one thing that, like, really makes me happy, and I'm just going to go for it. I've enjoyed the hobby for a number of years and just wanted to get involved with some people who are a little more knowledgeable, a little more experienced, kind of pick some brains and, you know, covet the equipment that I'll probably never be able to afford.
If there's something that you're looking for specific this time of year that's really exciting you, or?
Well, sometimes it just depends on what's in the night sky. It's like after you've been doing it for a while, you kind of know what's up there, so you revisit kind of old friends, and especially neat when you're moving up, it, you know, getting better and better equipment. It's like, oh, I saw that before, but I'm looking at it now in my 8-inch scope, and it's like amazing. So, you know, work on the project, revisit old friends. You kind of, some of it depends on the weather, depends on what is there in the night sky at the time. Certainly, you know, so like some of the planets are setting earlier now, but like Jupiter is making itself visible for the first time in like a year. So, you know, it just kind of depends on what's there.
Now, you can clearly hear there's almost a party atmosphere there, people chatting and laughing, and it's a very social thing, it seems, when you have these meetings of the society. It's not just a serious, quiet endeavor of looking at the stars.
Yes. That particular meeting that you just heard was more of a social event than others. We had a demonstration of telescopes, so there was a lot of people. We had, I forget how many telescopes that were in the room at the time. People brought their own equipment in, and everybody was roaming around and talking. Our monthly meetings are generally a lecture. We have many people come and give us lectures from the Boston area and what have you, from the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory. And so they're very interesting scientific lectures, if you will. Not dull and droll, but very interesting. So there's a lot of information. And then we have our monthly, in the winter, we have one public star party a month. In the summer, we have one every week, but we have one public star party a month. And then, of course, we have the outreach to the students at the high school.
Now, Michael West, I know you're currently chair of the International Astronomical Union's Working Group on New Ways of Communicating Astronomy with the Public. We've been talking about how inspired people get simply by seeing Saturn or the moon or reading about the stars. Why do we need new ways of communicating astronomy, and what might some of those new ways look like?
That's a good question, Heather. I think, you know, we live in an age of, you know, information overload in a sense, right? And so the question is how, with all these things vying for people's attention out there, can we make them aware of the night sky overhead and astronomy? You know, I think astronomy really provides a lot of food for thought about our place in the universe, you know, our planet and its future, all of that. And so I think, you know, things continue to evolve, and astronomy has to evolve with it if we want to be able to connect with the public, connect with people, and make them aware. So, for example, you know, social media, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, all of those things are growing in popularity every day. Astronomers are trying to embrace those as ways of getting the message out to people. And going back to this idea of astronomy as a very visual science, I think, you know, years ago, when I lived in Hawaii, I worked at an astronomy center we built called the Imiloa Astronomy Center of Hawaii. And we had a small area which was just astronomy as art, basically. No explanation, not telling you what you're looking at. Here are some beautiful images of the night sky. And, you know, it is a really beautiful universe. And so to try and find ways to use art to bring astronomy. You know, there's this whole issue of science education in the United States, and they talk about STEM areas, so science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And one of the directions people are going these days are called STEAM, which is to add art to that mix. So there's a lot of ways that you can be innovative and try and cut through all of the things that are trying to grab everybody's attention and let them know about the night sky overhead and their connection to the universe.
Well, so you mentioned actually showing pictures of the universe without any information, and science and art is a favorite theme and area for me. And I'm always curious, actually, whether individuals find the art or the images more compelling when they don't have information, or if they're more compelling when you actually tell them what they are. I mean, for me personally, looking at a beautiful picture of, you know, a nebula is absolutely gorgeous when you look at it and looks very abstract. It, for me personally, it becomes actually more interesting when you do put that information next to it and start to try to grapple with what it is you're looking at a scientific level as well.
Absolutely. And there are other places in the center, for example, where you do get that information. But the idea was, you know, often you kind of hit people with the image and the information at the same time. But sometimes it's nice to let people just kind of absorb the beauty of the image. As you say, some of these nebulae and everything in the sky are just so abstract, and they're like beautiful works of art. So to give people a few moments just to absorb that and enjoy it before you sort of hit them with the science and the factoids and everything, I think can actually be quite powerful for people.
I do want to tell our listeners that we have some astronomy photographs on our website to take a look at that, capeandislands.org. And of course, if you have questions or comments for my guests, you can join our conversation by calling 866-999-4626 or emailing us at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Now, Michael West, you have sometimes equated astronomy to art or music or literature, these endeavors that really creative endeavors that make us human. Do you feel that way about all science, or do you think that's something particular to astronomy, that just one field specifically?
Oh, no. I'm obviously passionate about astronomy. I don't understand why everybody on the planet's not an astronomer. But, I think in general that applies to science, of course. I mean, science is, you know, our attempt to understand the world around us, and whether that's biology, whether it's, you know, the work going on at Woods Hole, whether it's geology, chemistry, it's all trying to make sense and to describe the world that we see around us. That's, you know, that's a height of human accomplishment, I think. And so I think all science is, you know, plays this vital role in our culture and our evolution as a species. I think you know, I think it's one of the noblest things we can aspire to. And I think science also has a very functional role as well. You know, it teaches us things like critical thinking, for example, and how we might solve our problems, whether it's global warming or other issues. And so I think, you know, when you look at science as a way of viewing the world and trying to make sense of the world, it's actually a very powerful discipline.
We have a couple folks on the phone here that would like to join the conversation. Dana's giving us a call from Wellfleet. What's on your mind, Dana?
Hi, thank you. Yes, I am fascinated by the night sky in the respect that when you look up, or so-called up, from the Earth, you're looking back in time, oddly enough. We think of space as futuristic, you know, and everything, but you're actually looking back in time because that light, you see in the stars as they might have been anywhere from 2 to 2 million years ago, if not more. And to me, and it made me fall in love with the movie 2001 Space Odyssey as a younger person, and which says to me that we must, as a species, must learn humility in the face of nature and the cosmos.
All right, Dana, thanks for that call. I think that's probably one of those mind-bending aspects of looking into the night sky that does attract a lot of people, that you are looking back in time and trying to think about just how old that light is that you're seeing.
You are. Since light travels at a fixed speed, when you're looking back at something that you see something that's 2 million light years away or 13 billion light years away, you're looking back at that time. You're seeing those photons hitting your eye as it was 2 million years ago, not as it is today. So one of the funny things that you said mind-bending, it's just that. As you look further and further back in time and further into the universe, you wonder if what you're seeing is still there.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that you could actually never see what's going on currently. You know, for me, that's just, like I said, it's mind-bending to try to wrap your head around the fact that you will never actually see what's currently going on, if that's going to be somebody far into the future that will actually be able to see what's going on today.
True.
But that's true. Even, it gets sort of, you know, Zen or philosophical, but, you know, we're often told, you know, well, you should live in the present moment. And in fact, you can't. Even as we speak right now, right, there's a small delay between my voice reaching yours and you hearing me and all of that. It's virtually impossible to live in the actual current moment. Last night, I had a group of students out at the telescope out here, and one of them asked a really good question. She said, so if I was on a galaxy 65 million light years away, could I point my telescope at the Earth and see the asteroid hit the planet, the one that killed the dinosaurs? And the answer was yes. You know, the light of that impact is just reaching a distance of about 65 million light years from us now. So it's really amazing to be able to, that in principle, you can look back in time. You know, imagine if you were an archaeologist, you could walk the streets of ancient Rome, or you were a paleontologist, you could watch the dinosaurs roaming the Earth. And astronomers can really do that. We can watch the birth of stars and the birth of galaxies billions of years ago.
And this, of course, is why so many astrophysicists actually end up being metaphysical philosophers.
Well, Mencken said most astronomers end up going insane, actually.
Okay, well, that's maybe not the best ad for getting into astronomy, but Joel's giving us a call from Brewster. Joel.
Hi, speaking of amateur.
Hi, Joel.
Astronomers, there's a gentleman who is, I think, just turned his 96th year, who's known as a sidewalk astronomer, who sets up telescopes on city sidewalks and just let passerbys look at things. Now, some months back, I attended a memorial service of a friend of mine, and there were five mirror Dobson-type telescopes set up on the lawn outside there, all of which this guy built. And maybe Ed could tell people here in the Cape why there are so many Dobson telescopes on Cape Cod as a result of this sidewalk astronomer coming out here to the Cape and showing us all how to build a very cheap, money-wise, very fine telescope, learn how to grind your own lenses and everything else. It's, people around here ought to know that it can be done at charter school.
Well, Joel, we are actually going to take a short break. Thank you for your call. And when we come back, actually, we are going to give folks some pointers for what you can see both with your naked eye, what you might be able to make for yourself in terms of equipment, and what might be within people's budgets to actually set up a little bit of a home observatory. So we will definitely get to those tips. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests this hour are retired astronomer and meteorologist Ed Swiniarski and Dr. Michael West, Director of Astronomy for Nantucket Mariah Mitchell Association. We invite you to join our conversation. 866-999-4626 is our telephone number. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Now, just before the break, Joel gave us a call and was asking about some instructions on how to make your own telescope, and we will get to that in a minute, but Living Lab's Jenny Junker recently visited with Dennis Schmidt and brought back an audio tour of the night sky this month.
Oh, in fact, it's daylight. So there's a big star over there, which is the sun. I've gotten used to watching the sun and the moon and some of the planets. I kind of use it to orient myself in the solar system. Well, here's what's happening. The sun will set at about 6:15, and even before it sets, we might be able to see Venus in the sky. When the sun sets, Venus tonight will be at an altitude of about 15 degrees above the horizon. And it's such a bright object. Venus is always the brightest planet. Shortly after that, Mercury will set. It probably won't get dim enough in the sky to see Mercury before it sets. It's fairly close to the sun. It sets at 7 o'clock, so just 17 minutes later. A little bit after that, at 7:30, about, Saturn sets. Saturn you might be able to see, though, because the sun will be down a while, it'll be getting darker, and Saturn is a bright planet. Jupiter and Mars are visible in the middle of the night for night owls like me, get to see them. Jupiter is the second brightest. It's a very bright one, mainly because it's so big. It's a lot farther away from us than Venus. So you can see Jupiter in the eastern sky if you happen to be up late at night after midnight. It'll be the brightest thing over there. Mars rises 2:35 in the morning. Mars is dimmer, but it's still going to be moderately bright, and it's got a bit of a reddish tinge. Somebody way, way back knew that the evening star and the morning star were the same thing. You don't see both at the same time. Right now, Venus is an evening star. Once it swings past the sun and is on the other side, well, then you can't see it at night because it sets before the sun does. That's when it's a morning star. You can see it before the sun rises in the morning then, until it gets so close to the sun that it gets lost in the glare. But interestingly, the information got lost. The knowledge got lost, or the understanding or the belief that the morning star and the evening star were the same object. The ancient Greeks didn't know it. People before them did. Some people before them did. The Babylonians. By the way, the stars that we see, the ones that we see that are stars, those are all nearby. Nearby in the sense of they're all in the Milky Way. They're in the galaxy that we are in. There are 100 billion galaxies besides the Milky Way. We call them the fixed stars. Since antiquity, they've been called the fixed stars because they seem to be fixed. The ones that we see that aren't fixed, they were called planets, and planet means wanderer. But the fixed stars, pretty much everything is moving in the universe.
All right. A little bit about what we can see. Of course, this evening, the weather's not looking so good for watching the stars, but it doesn't change that quickly. We can hopefully see some of those later this week. I wanted to get some input from you, Ed Swiniarski, and Michael West, about maybe where some of the best places to go for naked eye observing of the night sky are. Is it literally just your backyard, or are there certain places around the Cape and Islands that might be better for trying to check out the stars and the planets?
Well, I could tell you that when we were searching for a place to put our observatory, we spent a lot of time looking at all over the Cape for where we thought the best locations were. The Mid-Cape is probably the least good because of you get the glare of Hyannis and Barnstable. But in this area where we're sitting here in Falmouth is usually very, very lovely. And also in the way out into the Wellfleet Truro area, we have beautiful
dark skies. Unfortunately,
we
can't go out to the National Seashore these days
not
with
right
the shutdown.
Now.
but usually right I would assume that would be but a wonderful place for stargazing.
Beautiful sight.
And are there specific spots on Nantucket or pretty much the whole island?
Yeah, I mean, the islands, it's quite dark again. My street, for example, where I live, there's no street lights, so I can see the Milky Way from my front porch, which is pretty nice. But, you know, especially with the beaches here, you go to any beach and you get a spectacular view. So the whole island is quite dark. It's nice for stargazing pretty much anywhere. And as a general rule of thumb, I mean, my advice is just get away from the lights. So anywhere you can go into the darkness, and you don't have to travel for miles and miles necessarily, but it really, really makes a big difference in terms of what you can see.
Now, what about folks that might be interested in having some equipment of their own? Can you make any recommendations about perhaps a telescope that might be relatively affordable for someone who would like to have a telescope at home, but also still give them some good observing power?
My first advice when people ask about what sort of telescope to buy is to think about getting a pair of binoculars. Because,
really?
You know, often people, they get intrigued by astronomy, and then they maybe, you know, it's not what they expected. They lose their interest. If you buy a pair of binoculars, you can always use them for other things. Also, binoculars are great for sort of sweeping the sky and just looking at different things. You know, I used to sit out in the backyard with my dad, and we would just use binoculars to look around the sky, and it was great fun. You know, here at Mariah Mitchell, for example, people bring us donations of old telescopes pretty regularly. They got one, they thought they were interested in astronomy, and after a year or two, it sits in a closet. So my advice is often, you know, start with a pair of binoculars. But also then, if you're going to buy a telescope, my advice, and Ed might have different advice, is to buy from a reputable manufacturer. You know, you can go to Walmart and you can buy a telescope, or you can go to many department stores, but they're not really the best quality telescopes by any stretch. Years ago, I was looking to buy a pair of inline skates, and I read a lot about it. And somebody made a point that I never forgot. They talked about what they called the crummy skate threshold. The idea was if you bought a cheap pair of inline skates, your feet would hurt, and before you know it, you're going to hate inline skating. And it's kind of the same thing with a telescope. if you're going to invest, you want to sort of buy the best one you can really afford, because if you buy a cheap one at the store, the optics aren't going to be very good, and you'll just end up disappointed in the end. So if you buy from a reputable manufacturer, it's like Meade, Celestron, Orion, you'll always get a decent quality telescope, I think. I don't know if Ed wants to add something as well.
Well, first off, I want to echo your comment about binoculars. That's a great way to start looking at, and just if it ever clears up this week, go out.
I think we're forecast for some clear skies, maybe even as soon as tomorrow.
If you got a pair of binoculars, go out and look at the southern sky, the southern part of the Milky Way. There, yeah, if you've got a clear night, you can see that. That's a great place this time of the year to scan with binoculars. You'd be surprised what you can see, and it's you know. Just beautiful again. Mike is right about the telescopes. Buy from a reputable manufacturer. You'll get bored you'll get bored and angry if you buy a very inexpensive one. And prices have gone down quite substantially over the last 10 or 15 years. You can buy a very, very nice telescope for it. You don't have to spend thousands of dollars.
So what about this idea that you could actually make your own telescope?
You can. It's a little bit strangely labor-intensive. Back in the old days, people used to grind their own mirrors and things like that. Today, you can go actually buy a mirror and then buy tubes and build it.
When you say buy a mirror, I mean literally just go out and buy kind of a hand mirror?
No. You can actually buy pre-ground astronomical mirrors from these catalogs. That's great if you want to go through all that work. But you can, as I say, you can buy some very comfortable, easy to use, inexpensive telescopes that are well made if you buy from these reputable manufacturers. One of your earlier callers, Joel, mentioned the person he was talking about was John Dobson, and he developed a design that makes very easy use, and it's not difficult to use the telescope. It's a visual thing. I can't really explain it on the radio, but it makes it very easy for someone to use.
Just in terms of the controls
physical,
and
the physical thing,
the arrangement
right?
of it.
And he was on the Cape, I forget how many years ago, and spent a school year here, or a good chunk of a school year, and worked with the students at, I think it was Lighthouse Charter School, which was then in Orleans, and built a whole pile of telescopes. They had every student building a telescope.
Now, you were mentioning as we were hearing about the night sky, that, of course, there are interesting things to be seen around the universe during the day. And the Wernerschmitt Observatory has actually invested in some solar telescopes as well.
Yes, we did recently purchase two very high-quality solar telescopes so we could look at the sun safely. It's got to be very careful. You just can't look at the sun through a telescope.
Right.
Has to have the right equipment. And we're starting to work with the students at the science classes at DY High with solar programs.
Well, and as you said, that has the advantage that obviously kids are in school during the day. It's not an extra thing to add on. You don't have to be a night owl up at midnight or 3 a.m.
That's correct. To
get a little taste of astronomy.
High school students are very busy these days, and they're not always available at 8 o'clock, at 9 o'clock at night.
Also great for public outreach. We just got a solar telescope here this summer, too, at Mariah Mitchell with a grant from NASA. And it's great for, you know, what we call guerrilla astronomy. You can just take it downtown and set it up by a cafe at lunchtime. And before you know it, you'll have a crowd. Everybody knows the sun, and they love to see the sun. And, yeah, you're not limited to only doing things during the nighttime. So it's a great new opportunity for public outreach.
Now, what kinds of things could you learn in terms of research with these solar telescopes, or is it mostly at this point kind of an outreach activity?
Well, it is an outreach activity, but the sun is, after all, a star. And so looking at, this is the one star we can actually see the surface of. And with using various filters and different wavelengths of light, you can see sort of different levels of the solar surface. And so besides it being quite beautiful to look at the sun, you can see prominences and specules on the surface. There's a lot to learn. It is a star, and it's a star that we can see in motion.
All right. Now, If folks aren't necessarily into investing in their own telescope, obviously there are observatories around where they can come. So let's talk a little bit about the activities that are going on at the observatories, and we'll start with the Werner Schmidt Observatory in Dennis.
From public outreach, where, as I said, during the summer we have a weekly star party. It's usually on Thursdays. In the wintertime now, we have a star party that's the Saturday that's closest to the quarter moon. Mike mentioned how looking at the moon is beautiful, and that gives us the opportunity to see the moon, and then as the moon sets, other things in the sky. And we are also open if anybody wants to give us a call and says they want to have a party. We do things for groups like the Scouts, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, and other things that people want to come. And so we're open to public.
So you have to have a little bit of astronomy awareness just to figure out when the party is going to be. The Saturday closest to the new moon, if you're going to the Werner Schmidt.
And if you just check our website, ccas.ws. is the website.
Now, Michael West, you also have, and you mentioned this earlier in the hour, opportunities for the public to come out to the Moriah Mitchell Observatory.
That's right. In the summer, again, we're open 3 days, three nights a week, because there's so many visitors to the island, of course. In the fall, we are doing it once a week, every Friday night. In October, it's at 7:30. People are welcome to come out to the observatory. No reservations are needed. We don't charge admission or anything. And then later in the year, November, December, like Ed's, the Werner Schmidt Observatory, we go down to once a week, usually during the first quarter phase of the moon, because it is the best time to see the moon. You see the illumination of the sun. You can see the craters and the mountains really, really nicely. But yeah, that's what we do. But in October and September, we're open every Friday night at 7:30.
Now, we were talking a little bit earlier about new ways to bring astronomy to people, and I've heard that you're interested in doing things like wine and cheese parties and music while observing the stars. Are those things in the works or still just ideas?
We're also talking about organizing a night sky festival out here on Nantucket. And it would be to celebrate the night skies out here, not just astronomy necessarily, but also the nocturnal animal life here on the island, or the arts. Again, I mean, so many artists have been inspired by the skies, right? From Van Gogh's famous Starry Night painting to poetry to music. And so why not celebrate all of that? So we're in the process of organizing a sort of Nantucket Night Sky Festival, which will also be a great opportunity to bring all of these things together.
Well, and then very exciting, the Moriah Mitchell Association is working on a new science center due to open in a couple of years that will also include a planetarium.
That's right. Yeah, that's super exciting. I remember as a kid going into a planetarium, and it's just like you're transported to another world. It's just unbelievable, right? And I'm sure many people on the Cape have been to the Boston, the Museum of Science Planetarium, or been to the Hayden Planetarium in New York, and there's just something mesmerizing about a planetarium. So to have this opportunity to reach out to the local school kids here on Nantucket, or from off-island, too. We get groups coming up from the Cape. I had a group from Connecticut here last night, a group of school kids. And also the many visitors to the island. We get 50,000 visitors on a typical summer day here. It's just a wonderful opportunity to really get people to understand and to feel some excitement about the night sky.
That's Dr. Michael West, Director of Astronomy at Nantucket's Moriah Mitchell Association. Before that, he was the head of science for the European Southern Observatory in Chile, where the world's largest telescope is under construction. Michael West, thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
We also spoke this hour with Ed Swiniarski, retired astronomer and meteorologist, currently secretary of the Cape Cod Astronomical Foundation, which is the governing body for the Cape Cod Astronomical Society and the Werner Schmidt Observatory at the Dennis Yarmouth High School. Ed, thanks.
Thank you.
You can see some photos of space and find more information about telescopes on our website, capeandisland.org. Next week, we're going to be talking with the heads of local science institutions about the role of collaboration in science and, of course, the recent government shutdown. Until next week, this is Living Lab on the Point. You can find Living Lab all week on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.
That begins following NPR.